It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. This is episode 356 of Jumbo Think.
3-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1.
Welcome to Jumbo Think, where we interview dreamers, makers, innovators, and influencers all about their journey of turning dreams and ideas into reality. Along the way, we're going to share some tips on how you can turn your own dreams and ideas into reality too. On the show today, our guest is Nadav Zemmer. More about Nadav in a moment. Whether you're a new listener or a longtime fan, if you've never subscribed to JumboThink, head on over to wherever you listen to podcasts, search for JumboThink, and click that magical subscribe button. To make it even easier, if you head on over to JumboThink.com, you'll find links to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, and more. Now let's join today's conversation. Hey there, friends. Welcome to Jumbo Think. My name is Michael Woodward. I am your host. We have a really special conversation lined up for you today. Now, I know I've been saying that a lot lately, and it's true for all of those conversations. We've been so fortunate with the guests who want to be on the show and who say yes to being on the show. And today we continue that trend with Nadav Zemmer. I am super passionate about the conversation we're going to be talking about. Education and how we approach it is something I think we need to be talking more about. And right now with COVID, so much of the conversation is about getting back to normal. I personally think that's the wrong conversation. I think we should be talking about how do we reinvent this space for a changing world, a changing economy, and a changing workplace. If we don't adapt, our children and our college students that are becoming the leaders, the engineers, the doctors, all of the different jobs that they're taking, if we're not preparing these people well, then we're not setting them up for a future that builds our nation, builds this world, brings hope, and brings just a fullness of what education can be. And so I am super excited about Nadav and having him on the show because he works at the intersection of technology and education. Nadav excelled as a software engineer in Silicon Valley prior to becoming an award-winning physics robotics teacher. He went on to become a principal and a public speaker. You see, the transition from software to education started when Nadav founded a nonprofit focused on hyper-local radio production. As a teacher, Nadav integrated podcasting into his curriculum and was selected to lead a school design team. For 7 consecutive years of breakthrough, student outcomes followed, along with widespread recognition for his digital media-centered approach to school reform. Nadav promises to end standardized testing in New York City high schools by 2040. That's a huge thing. Based on nearly 2 decades of experience, he has launched an open-source blockchain ledger of gold standard high school credits. We're going to explain what that means in a little bit, too. The Zemmer family adopted their eldest child from Japan and currently serve as foster parents to a medically fragile child in Harlem. He's the author of Education in the Digital Age, How We Get There, offers an evaluation of how digital technology and economics are poised to transform education by examining the concepts of academic capital. It's a really fun conversation. Nadav is a principal in Harlem. He is doing really cool stuff. Let's go ahead and join the conversation we had with Nadav. Our guest today is Nadav Zemmer. Zemmer?
That's it.
That's it. And super excited to have you on to talk about your book, talk about data-driven education, talk about a lot of various topics, and just excited to... I am passionate about the world of education, and so rethinking how we do education. And as an educator, I always like to hear that perspective. So I'm excited to chat about all of that.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really privileged and honored to be here.
All right, you got a book and it is called Education in the Digital Age, How we get there. We're going to talk about that in a moment, but how did you get here yourself? How did you go from, you grew up in Israel the first couple of years, end up in the States, end in the world of technology, and then somehow become a principal and an educator? How did you shift through that journey? That is quite the roundabout way to get into the world of education.
Yeah, so it's actually a loop. I started with, I was talking to you about a friend of mine from California.
Yeah.
I started with a few business partners. We created something called Sound of Mind. And it was basically podcasting in the late 90s, early aughts, before people knew what podcasting was. And we had a CD magazine because the internet couldn't handle audio. And and we were really decentralizing audio production and radio. And so that's where I started. I'm a really stubborn guy, so I kind of don't give up on things. I became a software engineer. I worked for a company called Great Place to Work Institute, and then moved to New York City to care for my grandparents and did consulting here. And I was always still looking at decentralization, open source, and media, and became a teacher in 2003, a physics teacher. My degree's in physics, so I became a physics teacher and ran a robotics program. And the whole time I used podcasting and I used video in my classroom. And then as a principal, I used video with my students, and it produced results that are rarely seen in education. When that little light goes on a camera and you point at a kid, their best self shows up. And I'd have teachers saying, I've never seen that side of a kid. I've never seen them step forward like that. So we were really able to bring engagement in a new way. And so now with the book, I started thinking about how can we take what we've learned, and it's really my staff who did the learning. I learned from them and I learned from the students. So take the learning from that community and how can we bring it to more schools, particularly in this pandemic era.
And that's the interesting thing. There's so many thoughts around education right now. We are in this shift. We have been an industrialized model of education, and now we're in this world of digital tools, whether it's virtual, whether it's robotics, whether it's AI, whether it's writing straight up code. There is this shift of how and why we work as adults, and yet we're teaching the same way we taught 75, 100 years ago. You are in this process of trying to figure out and reinvent it, and I love that. Why did that become important to you to say, you know what, maybe we need to change the status quo?
So the industrial model of education is increasingly irrelevant, but that's actually, I didn't see that for a long time. What I experienced is the coercive implications of a top-down, standardized approach to human beings.
Yeah.
Right. When we start from the top down and it's very coercive and it's very almost violent in the way people are forced to standardize their thinking and forced into boxes. And, you know, classrooms don't really want critical thinking in the industrial sense. You know, the industrialists didn't need their factory workers asking good questions or thinking about their purpose, but human beings do. And so I just felt this tension of what I didn't want to do harm to my young people. And I was trying to create a high school that didn't suck. That's really all I was doing.
Yeah.
And from a humanistic perspective and taking care of human beings and spending time being with human beings, what I did with my teachers is we stopped talking about what we're doing. And we started just looking at how we're being with the kids, right? Are we being playful? Are we being loving? Are we being angry, right? And which students bring out what in us, because that can tell us a little bit about who we're going to have effect with. And then everything else happened organically from the work of my staff. I had the most incredible staff at my school across, and so I can share stories about how we did different bits of it. But we ended up, so then when this COVID thing happened, I'd been watching media and working in education, and then suddenly things came together and people were kind of demanding, how do we educate our high school kids when we have to decentralize the schools?
I you know, you mentioned something, it was in the first part of your response there, and you said, you know, standardization really kills the individual. And I would pose that as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, as a person that owns a web agency, in the age we live in now, not only does it really steal from that individual, but it is actually counterintuitive to how businesses need to run in the age we're in. So we continue to teach this. This is the model. You have to learn this way. And then you have to give us the answer that we expect, the way we expect, just doesn't work when we need someone to critically come in and say, here's the problem. We haven't faced this problem before. Maybe it's a new technology like AI. How do we go about learning that? Well, you can't standardize that. You can't create a system around saying this is the only way, because there is no way at that point. And so by teaching a model that continues that strategy, it really not only stifles individuals, which is something that we need to take into consideration, but it also is now having the fallout of stifling innovation in the workplace as they grow older and get into the workforce. So I love the fact that you saw it at the individual level, and now we're seeing it as technology is evolving, as thought and work is changing, and how we do it, it's directly correlating. And to build a new generation of students to do that in the workplace is going to bring so much freedom and value to them that they didn't have 30 years ago or weren't expected to have in the workplace.
Yeah, and it goes a step further. You're talking about the implications for business. Think about the implications for these social media viruses of misinformation and disinformation. If you can't think critically, if you have to think of single right answers, if you can't evaluate to determine if it's signal or noise, we start spreading this misinformation and our society starts suffering. And then take it to democracy. Anytime we are fit neatly into boxes because we were standardized, it's very easy for someone at the top to manage our choices, to manage our attention, and to control us for their benefit. And democracy depends on us being able to advocate for our own benefit, right? And so for students to learn how to advocate for their own benefit, they need to learn to think critically. And that means that they are able to not think in those boxes and challenge those boxes so that they don't fall into them where they can be easily categorized by the AI engines. So it goes beyond just business. It's our democracy at stake, and it's our economic viability at large, not for individual business owners, but for any participants in the digital media landscape. Now, I forgot your question.
I think that there wasn't really a question. That got back to where we were for sure. I love that there are certain pockets in which educators are having the freedom to explore what's possible and rethink the institutions. I have a good friend named Aaron Smith, Dr. Aaron Smith from Virginia. He runs a STEM school at an avionics center where they're learning about avionics and applying science and math and engineering and art and design all into this process of exploring. And they're teaching high school students in unique ways. However, whether... Well, let's just go after the government for a second. They're telling our educators how to teach in a lot of circles. So how are you as a principal able to step out and say, you know what, I'm going to enable my teachers instead of stifle my teachers to actually say, go explore, figure out what works, figure out how you, you know, you mentioned earlier, you had certain teachers that would respond poorly to a specific style of student or not be able to teach with them. And you go, let's explore that. Let's figure out how we solve that problem. As a principal, I feel like you probably experience that more than anyone, that there are a lot of hindrances put in the way, a lot of roadblocks to stop you from exploring possibilities in teaching and learning. So how did you overcome those hurdles and enable your teachers, who are heroes in teaching a next generation, to have the freedom to live up to the potential that they have and not be hindered by a system that doesn't really, you know, you have people telling people what curriculum should be that aren't even educators. So it doesn't seem like it adds up. And yet you're able to work around that.
Yeah, there are so many places I could go. I'm very data driven because I came from a physics background. I really use data in kind of deep ways to get to human beings so that I could know which human beings to interact with at the right time. If you pull a young person into a room at the right moment because you notice that something's going on and they haven't expressed it, it's really easy to make a connection. Or if you visit them when they're in prison, or, you know, there are moments in people's lives that you can show up. And for teachers, the same thing. We have to just show up for them and see when they need us to be there for them as an empty cup and to receive. Now, but in terms of the tension with the industrial system that I'm part of, New York City in particular is a really tough place to innovate because we, for some reason, the culture in the New York City Department of Education is one that really threatens anyone that steps out of line.
Wow.
But what I found, there's a history here of that. But what I found is that human beings are bigger than any system.
Yeah.
So the person evaluating me, the person auditing me, the person investigating me, any person that comes in, no matter how nefarious their intention, when they walk into school and feel magic, they know that these kids are being served, and they all got into education because they want to take care of kids. So when they see it happening, I learned that they somehow learn to look away to let me keep doing what I'm doing because the proof is in the pudding. They walk into that school and you could feel it. I mean, our recording studio, our greenhouse, our science courses that were taught through a social justice lens, our karate dojo, like the way the students own that building, you walk in and you're like, oh, this is an amazing experience and I don't want to touch it. And so people were smart enough not to touch us. And I was dumb enough to take the risks to do that stuff before I knew that our test results would go up, because I ignored the standard. I refused to teach the standardized testing. I taught the project-based work, which is what – so I took a huge career risk because I knew I could go back into software. So I said, you know, let's go for it. And I overcame a lot of obstacles to become a principal. It was very unlikely for me to even become one. And then my model of leadership is service. I am not the leader in the building. The teachers are the leaders. We're an educational institution, and the teachers who have contact with the kids are leading us, period. My job is leadership support. And so when I look from that level of how can I empower the leaders in my building and I become a servant to their leadership, I think that that also helps those that want to make a difference. It helps them succeed a little bit more. And then I also use my art teacher to do all the professional development trainings for all the other staff. She was the one that so looking at everything through a lens of art was something that also gave us access to how to engage creativity in some subjects that usually don't see it.
I love this conversation because it dovetails with some other conversations we've had or will be coming up that haven't aired yet but are going to be airing around the same time. One of them is human-centered design, which is a powerful, powerful tool to approach problem solving because it brings together both the creativity. And I said this in that episode, you know, we look at analytics and we say they're not creatives, or they say they're not creative. And yet they're some of the most creative people because they're using that data to drive decisions. And yet that is a design process. And then we look at creatives and we say they don't have any value because they're not looking at data. And yet they bring beauty and elegance. And it's that human-centered design that brings those elements together of left and right brain and creativity and analytics that really makes something magical. The other conversation we recently had with a guest, Chad Veach, he was on. He just wrote a book called Help, I Work With People, and it's all about leadership and how leadership starts with yourself. And that, to me, sounds like the decision you had to make by bringing in that art teacher, by you yourself leading, and you use that word servant leadership to lead from a place of serving. That's not the model that, you know, the 80s capitalist model, which isn't the only capitalistic model out there, but that's not the model, you know, of greed and self-centeredness. It is a pivot away from that to say we look at humanity instead of the individual. We look at the whole. We look at how this comes together in cohesion. And at the end, what I see that you're doing is you're empowering not only yourself to bring new systems, but you're empowering your teachers and you're empowering the students to thrive. And so you make this pivot and you're seeing results of that outcome of the pivot. So talk to us a little bit about how those changes have impacted test scores or the outcomes of individual students and what they've gotten out of that process.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in there. So in my book, the main context that I talk about all this in is a shift from having a job, right? Punch in, punch out, get paid. To doing work.
Yeah.
Right? You get paid if you produce something.
Yeah.
And that's the shift that's happening. It's been happening for a long time, and companies have been kind of struggling with it. So within that context, that's really what I was looking at. How can we lead based on the quality of work we do, not based on our position?
Yeah.
Right? And so those are different aspects. And another piece I would say is it's not just you were talking about the data versus the creativity. There's also a piece of like the head versus the body and the heart. And so teaching whole human beings, not teaching minds, but teaching beings, right? Looking at body language, having programs that address the body, bringing mindfulness in a digital economy where attention is our value proposition, right? If we can't focus our attention, if we can't be mindful and focus it to produce a result that we are striving to produce, we won't be successful economically for, you know, the next era. So It's those pieces of bringing the whole human being in. So let me just give you an example of how I use data and I bridge that gap a little bit.
Yeah.
I had a heartbeat, a data heartbeat, what I called it. I asked teachers to put in grades once a week, right? Once a week, just look over your grades. You might put in grades every day. You might, whatever you do, you might base most of your class on a project that ends at the end of the term. So the data might not be good, but I just want something every week because what I would do is just look for changes. If I had a student who is failing all their classes, but suddenly 1 week I see they bumped up by 40%, you know, like that week they passed. Overall, they're still failing everything, but that week they passed, I go pull that student aside and congratulate them.
Yeah.
Now, on any other metric, they're failing all their classes. What are you doing congratulating them? But I would point a video camera at them and say, how did you do it? This week, you are an A student. How did you do it? I want to teach the other students, and I would put them in the center. I would give them attention. On the flip side, a student that suddenly dropped, you know, the data went in once a week. That means, you know, on average, I could catch within 2 or 3 days if somebody had a life event.
Yeah.
So I would get the data. I would look at it and say, woo, this something happened last week to this kid. I would pull the kid aside in a private space and they would start crying and saying, how'd you know? And I was like, what do you mean? How did I know? Your attendance number dropped. You know, you're no longer on time for your classes. Right. Little data. So the do now, which is the thing that we do at the beginning of class. I would just look at that to see if they're showing up for the class. Little bits of that. So the data isn't important at all. What the data tells me is where to go find the right human beings to interact with. And the work then happens in interacting and listening to that human being, and not just listening to them, but listening to the future I see for them, not to what they're presenting in front of me. I'm listening for something that I've created for them in the future. So I'm listening a very particular type of way in my interaction with them in a bigger context than what they see for themselves.
I'm a big fan of equality when it comes to the rights of people. And yet, on the flip side, that I think that that conversation has trickled down and caused a very damaging conversation. And what you're hitting on here, I think, really highlights that. When somebody is doing well, you treat them differently. When someone's doing poorly, you treat them differently. And so often our system has done a poor job of saying saying we're all equal, we treat people actually not right to the situations they're going through. And I think that that's the downside of saying we must treat everyone the same, is that not everyone is going through the same circumstance. Not everyone is going through the same victory. Not everyone's going through the same hardship. You can't treat different individuals the same and expect the same outcome. And by using data, which I've never seen data quite used like this, to be little flags that pop up and say, hey, celebrate this. Hey, there's something going on here and it has nothing to do with education. There is a deeper problem here. And by saying, you know, I need to treat this specific individual different because there's something going on here, that's really powerful in shifting how they even view themselves. And I think that we miss that by saying we've got to treat everyone the same and have that equality of treatment that actually hinders the possibility of unlocking the special uniqueness of that individual.
Yeah, it's so true. It changes the whole context, right? If a student's coming in and acting up and nobody finds out why they're acting up, they piss you off.
Yeah.
And they end up making you act up, right? Yeah. But then if I can pull aside a kid, we also did this thing that all the kids, we would watch to see their face as they turn the corner toward the school building. You can tell a lot when they turn and see the school building for the first time. You can see by whether they're pulled in or not what's going on with their education. And then as they walk in, I would have a team of people just looking at people's faces, because we had fights break out a few times early in my career. And people said, oh, I saw that coming. I said, I never want to hear that again. If you saw that coming, how did I not know about it?
Yeah.
So we would scan faces and body language as students would walk in and catch them. And so I can think of one young man who I became very close to and who I still keep in touch with, who came in one day and clearly was agitated. And he would have wreaked havoc that day. It turns out that armed gunmen broke into his apartment, people that I think he knows, put bags on their faces, held guns to their head while they stole all their things. Him and his brother were home alone. And he came to school the next day. So when I could email the teacher and say, hey, this is what happened to this young man, so that you know. And suddenly the teacher was looking at him like, what, you're here in school today?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Yeah. Right. And so they were looking at him differently. When he would act out, they would be like, no, come here, honey. Let me get you to sit down with some, let's give you a little private, like they just, the context was different. They got where he was coming from. And so just giving that context and reading that body language. Now, let me say something else about what you were saying, that the strive to treat everybody the same is a fool's errand. Mm-hmm. We are biased.
Yeah.
As human beings, if we didn't filter the world and had to take in all the data without bias, we wouldn't operate. We have to put things into categories. I'm obviously going to prefer my daughter over a strange girl, right?
Yeah.
I would have bias for my family, towards people that are like me, towards people that grew up in my neighborhood that speak like me. those biases are real. And instead of trying to treat everybody the same, we should just start being honest about how biased we are.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It's human. It's how we survive. It's a good thing. As long as we don't let it control our actions, as long as we say, hey, wait, I might be biased. Let me actively put that aside and say, hey, you're different from me. If I'm hiring, for example, you're different. I want to hire people that are different, but it's hard for me because my bias is going to be not to recognize your strengths. So I just want to put that out. And just by acknowledging it, let something happen that doesn't. So the idea that we can ever be unbiased is that same standardization mindset, which is total crap. We are biased. Let's own it.
And I think that media is a great example of that. They're, whether it's conservative or liberal media, they are wrapping bias as fact. And that's a dangerous place to live in because, you know, as you said, bias isn't necessarily bad. It's the believing it's absolute and truth that it becomes inherently bad, that my bias is okay and I can justify it as absolute and then force my bias on someone else. Well, that's really damaging. And when you take the time to say, okay, this is my bias, why do I think this way? Then you can start having conversations that bring education, that bring in a holistic view of this to the circumstances, to how you respond, how you're presupposed to actual action, and use that as a catalyst for change.
Yeah. If a teacher has the courage and has an environment to say, hey, I think that student's not going to amount to anything. I want to admit that because as a teacher, my job is to see them amount to something.
Yeah.
If you can admit that you have a bias because that student triggered something in you, like you said, it starts with you. Yeah. Why does that student trigger me?
Yeah.
Right. And it's me. It's not them. And then you can tell the student, hey, there's something about you that triggers me. I'm sorry. And you're going to have a rough time in this class, but I just want to put it out there. That's me. And when you see me doing it, tell me.
Yeah.
Right. Or going to colleagues and saying, I'm struggling with this kid. Right. When we can acknowledge our biases, we gain power because then we can do something about it. Like you said, when we confuse them for the reality or for the truth, it becomes very dangerous because we're living in non-truth.
Yeah. So good. As we pivot towards the end of this first segment, there's three questions we always ask. The first one is, for you personally, how do you find purpose in what you do?
I want to thank you for that question because our high school students need to be answering that question and nobody ever asks them about purpose.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's one of those things the industrialists didn't really want you thinking about. So I've thought a lot about this, and really as a high school principal, I'm looking at purpose for the whole community, but you're asking for me. But another way to look at that is narrative.
Okay.
Right? So the story we tell about our future in particular, not the past, but the future, that actually delivers our experience right now. So I find purpose in noticing the stories, what I'm confusing for this truth. Like, this is how it's going to happen. This is how that event is going to go, right? I have these things about the future that haven't happened yet that I think I know something about, and my wife is a great sounding board. So by noticing those narratives about the future is where I find purpose, because then I can craft a narrative that is mine. And when there is a story that is leading somewhere that's exciting, right? When what's about to happen is I'm about to change the world of high school education, there is purpose. Yeah. And I believe that, right?
Yeah.
I'm not BSing myself. I'm actually in reality. And then I'm noticing when I stop believing it and think I'm full of shit, right? And so noticing this narrative I have of the future is really where I look for turning purpose back on when it goes out.
What is one challenge you're currently working to overcome?
You know, it's funny. I used to say people's fixed mindset about how education is supposed to be. But since coronavirus, that's not people are totally open to change. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But one challenge that has been my challenge for a long time is taking my body for granted, my health and well-being. I do not manage that with integrity or well. My health is a challenge that I'm really looking to overcome right now.
What's the next big dream, idea, or goal that you have?
To end standardized testing.
Love
in
that.
High schools in particular, period. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a break right here. And when we come back with Nadav, we're going to go deeper into this conversation. We're going to talk about the impact of COVID-19 and how we can actually use this as a launching pad into a better future for education. We're going to take a break right here, but we'll be right back. A few weeks ago, we had Nick Walenda on the show to talk about his new book about facing fear. You might remember Nick from walking on a tightrope across Times Square or across the Grand Canyon or even across an active volcano. His book is incredible, and for one of our listeners, I want to get it in your hands. All you have to do to enter is simply go to jumblethink.com and sign up for our email newsletter. In a few weeks, we're going to be drawing one name, and I'll be sending it to you so that you can read the book too. So head on over to jumblethink.com and sign up for that newsletter.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now let's return to today's conversation. We are back to continue the conversation with Nadav Zemmer. And before we do that, though, you have a book, you have a really killer blog where you talk about education, the foster system, and why you foster kids, and that's really cool. You talk about tech. You write quite a bit on Medium with some really insightful articles. I was on there actually earlier today just skimming through again and just really enjoying that. How can people find and connect with you?
So if you just go to Principal Z, Principal A-L, right, Principal of the School, principalz.org, you can join my mailing list, or if you email me at info@principalz.org, I read all the emails and I'll respond to you personally. I'd love to hear from people.
Before we dive in to continue the conversation, I love New York City. It's my favorite place in the world. I probably would be living there in an ideal, perfect world one day, maybe. Harlem, though, has a reputation for being rough and tumble. Think of Bronx, I think of Harlem, and I think of those coming together. And yet there's a resurgence, a renaissance that was birthed out of Harlem, of course, with jazz and black culture and everything like that. And I feel like there's this resurgence in the Bronx and Harlem happening again. What are you seeing there?
So there are a lot of things happening. I think that we still face a lot of the challenges, particularly the South Bronx, which is, I think, the poorest congressional district in the country. There are still some real issues we face with that poverty. We also face issues when that poverty starts going away and gentrification happens, right? So from the context of a human being among human beings, what I'm looking for is community and how strong the community is, because then we can together we can overcome a lot more than if we're separated. And I have concerns in Manhattan in general and in Harlem in particular. Harlem is actually much more community centered than a lot of the other places I've lived in New York. But the big box stores and taking over from the local cobblers. New York used to have these small businesses that were handed down through generations, watch fixers and or just tiny businesses of any kind, little restaurants, and a lot of them are being taken over by, Olive Gardens. So that worries me tremendously, and I think everybody's kind of aspiring to that big, takeover of the big box stores. But then at the same time, there are strong communities happening here that buck that trend, and there are a few amazing locations. So I think like any city anywhere in the country, there's a mix. I think the big thing that's happening is a divide between our cities and the countryside, and that actually worries me more than anything else. I think in the city we'll face adversity together just as they do in the countryside, but I would love to bridge that gap maybe.
Love that. And I have a friend who lives in the Lower East Side, which is gentrifying itself quite a bit over the last few years. And he said, how bad you can gauge how bad gentrification is going by how small the dog gets and how many Whole Foods pop up.
Exactly.
So, I want to continue this conversation on rethinking education around the point of view of COVID-19. One of the things that drives me nuts, we homeschool, partially because it allows us as a family to travel when I'm doing things for the show or for work. We can go as a family. My wife works from home, so we have a lot of freedoms there. And yet, I grew up in a very affluent area that had an incredible public school, and I love dearly. I live in that school district again when I move back to the East Coast. And so I have a love for the public school, but the thing that drives me nuts is this rush to say, hey, let's get back to normal.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the way things have always been. And I know that people thrive for what's familiar. They desire for it. And yet that I don't think is a really good conversation. COVID-19 is the perfect time to say, how do we reinvent education for a new generation? How do we reinvent education for a new decade, a new century? How do we re-engineer education for a society that's changed from what it was in the 1950s?
Yeah.
And instead, we're in this rush to get back. So for you, as you look at COVID-19 and you're rethinking how that impacts the school that you're a principal out in Harlem and how it impacts your school, what are you processing?
Yeah. So there's a crisis. And it hasn't even hit yet. It's going to hit probably in September or soon thereafter. What happened with, in March, the pandemic hit. And a lot of students didn't show up to their online learning, but budgets were being cut and social distancing was coming. And so we couldn't afford to fail those kids, because then they would repeat the grade and we have twice as many kids with fewer resources and not enough space. And so we kind of just said, just give them those credits. Just give them those credits. And there was a little bit of pressure from the state even and the city to say, we're going to look the other way. If they, even if they didn't show up at all to online learning, that might not be their fault. Maybe they don't have the money, but whatever, let's just give them a break. So now when we come back in September, there are a lot of kids are going to be like, wait, I got free credits last term.
Wow.
Right. And they're starting. And not to mention that they, I don't like standardized exams, but all the exams were waived. So there's no accountability for these students in terms of making sure that they get some value. I don't want to measure that value in standardized exams, but right now we're just not doing anything. And so with budget cuts, with social distancing, there is going to be a crisis coming. And I think that we're going to keep what they call prioritizing the standards, meaning reducing and reducing and reducing to the point that that just like if you print too much fiat currency, it loses all of its value. And so yeah. We're just printing credits at a rate that by the way, I only know high school. I think elementary and middle school are totally different beasts and I don't understand them at all. But in high school, the quality of a high school credit is already gone to zero.
Wow.
Right. And so the politicians are always incentivized to water down the credits so that it looks like the scores are going up. And every 4 years, even if they're doing something well, they'll change it just because they want to change from the predecessor. So we have to take credits out of the hands of the government and the lawyers and put credits in the hands of educators. They know, and they can think long term and they know what quality learning is. So I'm actually spending, I have my day job with the Department of Education, but my nights and weekends are spent working with the team in Europe designing an app that we hope we can have out in September, at least for a local trial here in Harlem, that does exactly that. It is a way for a student, instead of sitting for by the way, one thing I didn't mention is think about exams. Nobody's going to go sit in a room packed with kids to take exams anymore, right? So now you're doing exams on the computer from home, very problematic. So how we're addressing that is we're going to let kids upload a video instead of sitting for an exam. So yeah. You can get an AP credit by uploading a video or a podcast, right? And there's a ton you learn in making a video or podcast. And these are not, social media is whip out the camera and take a quick video. This is not like that. This is a platform where the most you can post is once a month, right? You spend a whole month on a single credit. So you take that whole month to work on that credit. You do at least three revisions. You have to upload three revisions to the system and you get support throughout those revisions. So it's highly revised, it's researched, and it's relevant because although the credits tell the kids what skills they're going to practice, fact-checking or research or questioning, the content the students can choose. So they can choose to go to the protest and cover it as a hyper-local journalist using academic skills to produce a podcast and then get that credit by uploading that work. Right. So that's the app that we're designing that will come out shortly. And not only do I think that will help end standardized testing and let teachers, instead of teaching to test, teach toward high quality student work. And it goes back to that doing work versus having a job thing. Right. We're teaching kids work ethic. You have to produce quality content and it's not evaluated by your teacher who you can sweet talk or a guilt trip or whatever. It's evaluated online by an anonymous committee of credit experts. And there's no way around that. So we're actually we're creating a gold standard credit that, it's going to be much easier to compete with any New York City credits that have zero value. Let me say one more thing, though. If you focus just on one credit per month, it sounds slow. It sounds deep. How can they do that? It turns out if you do the math, in New York City, you get 22 credits, annualized credits, in the course of your four-year high school career. If you do one credit per month and you skip September and you skip June, so you have ramp up and close out times, just the months from November to May, 8 months, times four is 32. You get 32 instead of 22. You get more credits by just doing one time.
Yeah.
Right. So we're producing high quality credits, going deep. You actually get more credits, so you can start getting college credits when you finish the high school requirements. And so and these credits are decentralized. So you, with your podcast, can set up a podcasting credit that you think is something that students should learn in high school. And if students respond to your credit and they upload work to have you grade it, they're paying you $100 for every credit to grade it. So you actually can make money by creating high school credits. So I'm asking the world, what should we teach in high school? And letting everybody put it out there. And then we can have national organizations. We can have, you know, as a high school principal, I can say to the students, hey, this credit will count toward English in this school, right? Yeah. So a principal can choose it, or the school district, or the college board could even choose some and say, hey, that counts as an AP credit. And they can take some of that money instead of from tests, they take that money to grade project-based work.
That's really cool. And it sounds awesome. Where can people find and keep up to date on that? Because that is something that, you know, I'd love to keep an eye on and watch as it happens over the next year and see that evolution, get involved and be a part of it. How can people stay up to date on that?
So once we, you know, they say before beta testing, you're in dark mode where you're not supposed to talk about things.
Yeah.
We're in dark mode. I can't even tell you the company it's a gaming company actually that's building this for me. And they're donating all the engineers. So you won't get me to shut up about this in just by the end of the month. I think we'll have the prototype out and then I'll talk to everybody. But what I'll say is my mailing list, if you just go to principalz.org and join that mailing list, I will share updates there as soon as I can, because I'm excited to share. I think you'll be everybody knows the video game that these guys produced. And I think it's really fun to see the app that they're producing. I'm already playing with it, and it's really exciting. So just that mailing list is the best way to stay in touch.
Do you think, and I'm going to stay up to date on that because I'm super excited about that. But do you think in 10 years, students will still be, as the majority of their time, sitting in a classroom learning the traditional methods? Or do you think that in 10 years from now, we're going to see a radical shift?
I think just because of COVID, 11th and 12th graders will be sent out of the school building to be hyper local journalists, to go, you know, report on stories and create content together. Those that earn the right, those that know how to, you know, behave and be safe and be professional. And then other students will get more one-on-one support in a classroom, but it'll be much more intimate, much more focused on them as human beings. And I think 9th and 10th grade is a transition before you might be adult enough and professional enough to do that and to go out on your own and ride the subway and not go crazy. And so the educators know which students they can unleash into the world. And so the students that are not ready will get embraced a little more. There'll be more wraparound services, because a teacher can teach 30 kids if they're spending 4 days a week out of the building and they just have to touch base in a circle with them to get updates about their project and share. It's you know, it's a much different model than having them there in a room and every 40 minutes a bell ringing and moving. So I think we're going to go deeper. I think the high school building will still be an important place for students to have a safe place. But I don't think it's going to be this industrial bells ringing, Carnegie units, you know, seat time, clock in, clock out, get your credit and learn nothing.
One of the other things that frustrates me most about education is that it is in its own space. And so often a lot of educators segment away from engagement in the world outside of the school when it comes to embracing education. Now, years ago when I was in Chico, California, I was a part of a board for a school district that helped create curriculum around the world of coding. I owned a web agency, still do. And so they're like, you're doing this. What do we need to be teaching students? How do we get more of that, where educators in the business world, educators in the government, educators in the entertainment space, the entertainers in the environmental spaces, across all of these different sectors, how do we have partnership that goes deep and rich? And you know, it's one thing for an educator to come in and say, this is all the stuff I think you should be learning around, let's say, code, because that's the world I know. It's another thing for somebody who eats, sleeps, and does it every day and makes a living off of it to come in and say, this is what is expected in the real world. How do we partner more? How do we make the education actually have value once somebody leaves a classroom so that it transfers into those spaces better? And instead of being segregated between our spaces, here are the educators, here are the business leaders, here are the technical leaders, here are the political leaders. How do we, and I'm not saying on the flip side, have people like me saying this is the only thing you need to teach and demanding our way. How do we create true partnerships so that there's value there, so that there is a real understanding of teaching information well that is relevant to today?
Yep. You open source the credits, right? So it's exactly what I was talking about before. If I let all those industries, all those people create their own credits and make $100 per piece of work uploaded for those credits, so there's actually a financial incentive. On top of that, if you're a public radio station, you're also getting youth voices that you're determining what they're about and what how they're structured. So you're getting free content, essentially, plus $100. You're getting paid for the privilege of getting this content. It's right. A great value proposition for media, but also, like you said, for environmental, for coding, for any industry to say, I think it's important for this to be taught in high school. You go out and create a credit. And what that means is you write really good project-based curriculum, because our teachers should not be writing the curriculum. They should be delivering. They should be with the kids. They shouldn't be going home and having to write on top of that. So if you write stuff that the teachers love and that is useful, and tutorials that students can follow, or build an app that students can follow, make it easy as possible to deliver the content, then teachers and students will adopt it and use it. You'll get paid and you'll get your credit active in high schools. That's the flip, right? That's the inversion of the industrial model, where it's centralized from the top down, where the standards never change. They change once every 20 years. So they're totally out of touch. They're totally irrelevant. But now you can have a Black Lives Matter credit that becomes the big credit to get this year, but next year it's a different credit, right? And the coding credit, where the person says, I don't care what you learn, I care what you do. Mm-hmm. Get your hands dirty and do stuff by producing code. I know you learned something. I'm actually not going to tell you that you need to learn if then, and I'm not going to give you that, right? So the coders know how to teach code. They know how to get the kids' hands dirty by doing rather than by talking about it. And similarly for every other industry. So if industries want kids to arrive to their industry prepared, they can create high school credits that serve the teachers, that students are excited to produce, teaching skills that the students then apply those skills to areas that they're interested in terms of content. And I think that decentralization of credits, and then the credit, obviously your bar for accepting a credit and declining a credit has to be good enough that when parents look at it, when districts look at it, they say, this is definitely worth a credit. This is definitely 180 hours worth of work, which is what one of these credits that I'm designing is worth. New York State's 108. So our credits actually take more work because we integrate the homework and the classwork. Anyway, so I think by decentralizing high school credits and let anybody create a credit, we start having an ecosystem, a marketplace of credits, where the most useful credits for the students and the teachers are the ones that work, and it gives everybody an opportunity to impose their thoughts on education.
I want to circle back as we wrap up the second segment to your book, Education in the Digital Age, How We Get There. Who's it written for? Is it written for the educator? Is it written for the parent? Is it written for the student? Who is it written for, and what are they going to get out of that book?
So it was written actually for the open source decentralized community. So kind of like the blockchain community is where I started. Yeah. Because I really thought that the decentralized trust that Bitcoin proves is possible, right? If you can decentralize money, you can decentralize high school credits. So the Bitcoin blew my mind that it even exists. I still don't believe it. So I was really talking to people that get those trends, and then people that want to learn about those trends. If you want to understand what inversion is, the first half of the book is economics, is just talking about teaching you what does it mean to invert an economy? What does it mean to have a digital economy? So if you want to understand what digital economics are, I really wrote the book to explain to people the world our kids are graduating into, because one of the arguments I make that we haven't talked about is that diversity is critical to critical thinking. Without diversity in the people you exchange ideas with, if all the people think like you, you're not doing critical thinking. Right. And our parents too often want their kids to go to schools with kids that are like them. And I think we need to fight for our schools to be much more diverse, just as a way to educate our kids. So I was writing to anybody that wants to understand what I'm seeing as an educator and a former technologist about the world our kids are stepping into. And then at the end, I bring it all together to talk about how do we actually apply those ideas of decentralization, of inversion, of collaboration and positive sum dynamics to education.
Love it. Well, we're going to take a break right here. And when we come back, it is time for rapid fire questions. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Chasing big ideas and dreams is hard to do. Doing it alone makes it almost impossible. But where do you find a community of dreamers and idea makers just like you? Here at JumbleThink, we wanted to help, and that's why we launched the completely free JumbleThink Facebook group. All you have to do is head on over to jumblethink.com/group. It'll take you right to the Facebook group where you can join our community. So head on over right now, jumblethink.com/group, and let's start dreaming together.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now let's return to today's conversation. We are back with Nadav. All right. Are you ready for rapid fire questions?
I'm ready.
As a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I think a diplomat, something like that, where I could work. I liked seeing conflict turn into resolution. That really was something I always loved.
What is one tip you'd give someone with a big idea or dream and they don't know where to start?
Start in your body. Take time to breathe. Take time to feel your body. And then that will lead you to action, right? And to honor your heart. And if you're in touch with what's going on in your body, not just what's going on in your head, it will guide you. It's much smarter than your head is.
What is one change you'd like to see in the world?
That high school is a really magical place, is really time in our lives that we all agree is magical. And our high school buildings are a place where magic happens.
What do you want your legacy to be?
I want something that I create to grow up in the world. And what I mean by that is that no one knows that it came from me, right? Like, think of something like AA. Do you know the guy that created it? I don't. There is a guy, I think, that created it. Right. And so something like that, I want something that people have no idea that it came from me, but that it's that it gets its own legs and lives in the world without me.
Where do you find inspiration?
My kids.
What is one book you think every dreamer should read?
So again, I'm going back to the body. The Body Keeps the Score is a good one, or My Grandmother's Hands, if you want to look at it from a race perspective or social justice perspective. But The Body Keeps the Score, I think, is a good one to start, because our dreams do come from our bodies, our subconscious. You know, our bodies and our minds are connected. And if you let the connection between them open up, your dreams get some meat and some blood and some guts, and they start turning into something a little more out of your own control, and that will surprise you.
For you, how do you define success?
So provide for my family and do so while doing good for the world, not provide for my family by cheating and stealing, which can be hard. And then not take things too seriously, kind of laugh every day.
What is one trend you are currently excited about?
Oh my God, open source software. And open source is a concept. Like, the fact that GitHub sold for $7.6 billion, right? Or MuleSoft to Salesforce for $6.5 billion, all the way up to Red Hat, $34 billion. Like, the fact that open source, that people working for free is in the platforms to empower them, are making some of the biggest tech acquisitions in our industry. If you would have told me that this was going to happen, you know, when Linux was starting, I would have said, you're nuts.
Yeah. What is one habit you find helpful in your life?
Critical. Meditation.
What is one thing you wish you would have known when you first started out?
Oh my God. I wish somebody would have told me that I was going to be my wife, because so much of my energy went into wondering and worrying. And if I would have known this woman that I'd have next to me and I just knew that was going to happen, I would have had a lot more energy to do good in the world.
Love that. If you weren't doing what you're doing today, what do you think you'd be doing?
I mean, I think I know. I almost didn't become a teacher and I almost didn't become a principal. The stories are really amazing that I got rejected from every step of my life. I wasn't supposed to be where I am. So I would be back where I started, being a tech consultant, kind of translating from software teams to marketing teams. I think I'd still be doing that because it was making me a lot of money.
And our final rapid fire question, what is one dream you're still wanting to fulfill in your own life?
This app that we create, I want it to become the largest high school district in the country in terms of advanced credits it's awarded, because that'll be a sign that our students are producing work, they're ready for the digital age, and standardization and standardized testing are on their way out.
Now, Dav, I always like to leave our guests have a final thought. What is your final thought for us today?
Final thought. You know, it's what I'm always thinking about, and I invite you to think about it with me. Education is critical to the digital economy and to democracy. It's not just for education or for our kids, right? If we have an ideas economy, teaching kids how to, you know, that's really at the heart of being successful economically. So I think if we want to have a strong economy, we want prosperity, we have to look at our schools and we have to look at the crisis that they're facing. And I just invite all of you to, to realize that that's such a high leverage point to get into, especially our high schools, and do whatever you can to make your local high school a magical place.
Thanks so much for taking time and joining us here on JumbleThink. It's been a lot of fun. This is one of my favorite topics, the world of education and rethinking education. So it's been just an honor to hear your story and your insights into this space.
Thank you so much.
Once again, we want to thank Nadav for taking time out and being on the show with us today. His links are in the episode notes. Go check out what he is doing. I also want to thank you for tuning into today's show. It means the world to me that you would listen. And I hope today's episode has inspired you to rethink what's possible, to rethink how you can form and shape the future for your kids and for yourself. That's my challenge to you today. Think about what you're doing and what's working and what isn't working. And the things that aren't working, instead of just continuing down the path of doing the same thing, reinvent them, rethink them, and create a new path forward. Thanks again for tuning in. Now it's your turn to get out there, dream big, and change the world around you.
Nous avons voulu en faire connaître la force. Vous verrez comment un simple disque peut aller plus loin que vous ne l'auriez imaginé. Mettez-vous dans une tenue légère. Ôtez tout ce qui peut vous gêner ou tirer votre attention. Cherchez la meilleure position. Les bras et les jambes légèrement espacés. Étirez-vous doucement, mais complètement. En avant, en arrière, sur les côtés. Vous êtes une autre personne. Les mères de famille, les enfants, peuvent également prendre un moment revitalisant. Dans quelques mois, lorsque vous aurez bien saisi la technique et que vous serez maître de votre corps, vous pourrez vous décontracter même en travaillant.